There's a late 19th century French novelist named Léon Blois who wrote a book called The Woman Who Was Poor. And one of the statements he made in that book was, or one of the statements he is quoted as having made in his life is, that there's only one sorrow, the sorrow of not being a saint. Now, the context in which he said that didn't have anything to do with people with halos or people who were so holy that they're not somebody we could attempt to strive to be like in our lives. What the context of that statement was is the sorrow is that people miss the mark, that they're not whole. Holiness is wholeness, that you don't become the person you were meant to be. That you go through your life, you're born, you go through your life, and you die, and you never become the person that you were meant to be. That of all the people who have ever lived, you're the only one like you. The poet says, what I do is me, for that I came. That I came. I came into this world to be me. And so the question is, who am I? And as you listen to this series and as you listen to me tonight, that's the question I want to focus on for you throughout the series. Because I think that is the crisis in the family today. That people have lost a sense of themselves. That we have what I would consider the universal human problem, a wrong perception of ourselves. And in one sense, that's the only problem. In all the years of counseling that I've done, that's the problem that emerges over and over again, a wrong belief about ourselves. People have a wrong belief about themselves. And out of that wrong belief comes wrong choosing. The choices I make in my life depend on the belief I have. For example, your belief about the world will condition how you react to the world. I tell the little story of my friend who picked me up at Christmas to go shopping, and his father was with him, and then my friend is just this wonderful, happy guy, and his father hates the world. And his father believes that people are no dang good. So my friend drove Houston traffic during the holidays. Took about 20 minutes to get to the Galleria, almost unheard of. He's smiling at people and they're letting him in traffic. We get through with our shopping a couple hours later and the father says, let me drive. Gets to the wheel of the car. I'm talking to my friend. I don't even notice. 20 minutes later, we're not out of the Galleria parking lot. And I look over at this guy's face. And he's just glaring at people. And pretty soon, a sweet little lady lets us in. And he calls her a dumbbell. And you see, what I began to realize, here this guy creates the kind of world he believes is out there. He believes the world is no good. He creates that world by his whole attitude. And even when there's data to the contrary, that the world is nice, he discounts it. Because it doesn't fit his belief system, his map of the world. So whatever you believe about yourself is going to be the map you use to make every decision about your life. That's the crucial question. What is it that I believe about myself? Now, I don't mean that I can look in the mirror and know I have a good job or know that people like to hear me lecture. That isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the core, kinesthetic, the deep feelings about yourself. What will I show you about me? You see, the more I believe I'm okay, then the more spontaneous and unguarded I will be. I don't have to hide myself from you. I lived my life a great deal of the time addicted to my own shame, my own belief that I wasn't okay. So I wouldn't show anybody a lot about me. There's still parts I won't show. Some of them are appropriate, some of them are not so appropriate. But I was literally controlled in my life by my shame. Shame is to be guarded about being unguarded, if that makes any sense. You're not going to let go. You're not going to be spontaneous. You're going to miss the mark if the deepest part of you believes you're not okay. So shame is the crisis in the family. Everything I'm going to show you in this series will go back to this core belief in people that they're worthless, that they really are not okay, that they're flawed, that somebody's going to find out if they expose, that is, if they really trust and show themselves. That, to me, is the deepest human problem, this loss of ourself, this loss, if you will, of the image of God in us that we don't believe in. Now, the whole issue of that belief about myself or that shame instead of that self-love and that self-worth has to do with how I learned about myself. It has to do with how I learned about myself. And how I learned about myself was in a family. How I came to know what I could feel about myself, what others felt about me, happened to me in a context. Now, it isn't that that family, what happened to that family can never be changed. It can be changed. But it has a lasting impact on my life. The rules that I grew up with, the set of rules that I took on internally and came to use to manage my life were learned in a family. So the whole issue of shame, of people acting out of shame. Now let me talk about some of the ills of our time. And let me tell you right off that we have a lot of denial about this. We have a great deal of denial about it. If I start saying that 60 million Americans are seriously affected by alcoholism, that's one quarter of our population. 60% of the women in this culture are overweight, probably into some kind of eating disorder. 50% of the males are overweight. That is, in an unhealthy bodily state. Many don't even know about their bodies because they're so dissociated from them. So we drink and we put pills and we put caffeine. See, we put all these things in our body in order to be able to feel our bodies. Shame-based people have to do that because the core of shame is so deep. You see, my shame governed my life for years and years and years. That is, it controlled what I would show you about me, but listen to this. It controlled what I would look at, finally, about me. As I begin to sort of plan around my shame and compulsively act out of my shame, I get to the point I don't even look at me. And do you see the great danger in that, the unexamined life, that you don't even know yourself because you're so busy covering up the deep feelings of inadequacy or unworthiness? So it's terribly important to see that the diseases of our day, what we eat, the eating disorders, we have at least four kinds of serious emotions that are called eating disorders, compulsive eating, bulimia, anorexia, fat thin. We'll talk about that later on when I talk about compulsivity. The fat thin disorder where you obsess all the time about weight. Am I going to eat? I shouldn't have eaten that donut, but I ate the donut, but I don't want to go there because maybe I'll eat a donut. Drive yourself crazy with this obsessive mental process about eating. Okay, 34 million adult women walking around in our society were sexually abused. That's the statistic that came out of the 1984 Life magazine featured story on incest families. 34 million adult women. Terry Kellogg says one out of four women in this culture are sexually abused severely or mildly by age 13 by somebody over 18, and 80% know they're offenders. That's a horrible statistic. 10 million people are the victims of violence in the family every year in the United States of America. 10 million people in their own families are victims of violence. Now, some of these overlap. That is, a lot of the violent people are also alcoholic or drug addict, or some of those disorders overlap each other. So we need to be a little bit careful about statistics. And statistics are like bikinis. They reveal a lot, but they hide vital spots, somebody said. So I don't want to go so far with statistics, okay? And there are lots of other statistics. 9 out of 10 married men at some time in their life will have an affair. They're having an affair. They've got to be having an affair with a woman. So that means an awful lot of women are having affairs. So there's a tremendous amount of data now. And then the divorce rate, more than half the families are ending in divorce. We have one of the most serious problems we've ever had in this culture of children running away from home. When we do the studies on those runaway children, what are we finding? That they're getting knocked around, violently abused, or they're getting sexually abused, or they're from alcoholic families, or they're from compulsive addictive families. So the diseases of lifestyle, what we eat, what we drink, the medicines we use, the stuff we use in the morning, sleeping disorders. Stress insomnia is a huge disorder in this country. Sleeping pills, tranquilizer sleeping. It's a huge disorder in this country. Our entertainment. Lots of people are addicted to entertainment. They compulsively watch television or go to shows or cannot live unless there's something outside of them to make the inside feel less lonely. Have to have excitement, or you have to have noise, or you have to have something, because you see, the shame core, once you go in there, I just can't live in there. It's too lonely, it's too unfilled, it's too unfull, it's too empty. So the diseases of our day are diseases of lifestyle. They have to do with our lifestyle, the way we work. Studies are showing that workaholism is one of the most serious compulsions going. That workaholic families, the kids will act out in those families as severely or more so as in alcoholic families. That if dad is never there, that our mom is never there, but more often dad, because work is presented in our sex roles as the way to be successful, because the way to be successful is to make money in our culture. See, and money is worth. And if you feel like you don't have any worth, then money can compensate. Cars, jewelry, possessions can compensate for the sense of lost worth. So this is the disease. This is the sickness. This compulsivity. This compulsivity. The very things that we eat, the way we sleep, the way we entertain ourselves, the way we work. Alcoholism is probably the leading killer in this culture. We don't say that. We say something else, but that's because a lot of people don't put on the death certificates the way that the person really died. They died of going over a bridge. How do you put that on the death certificate? Or cirrhosis of the liver, or liver complications, we might say. And as we look at the range of disorders and the compulsivity, that's what I like to focus on, that out of that shame base, another way to look at the crisis is to say that we're in a crisis of compulsivity. And that compulsivity itself is set up in family systems. That the initiation into compulsivity always takes place in families, and the way it takes place is out of some form of abuse, which in its initial sort of initiation was salvific. That is, I'm a workaholic because I can't deal with my feelings. I don't have any feelings of tenderness or feelings of dealing with my children, so I'd rather stay at work and be into the impersonal excitement of making money as opposed to the threatening intimacy of home and the getting close and the expressing feelings. But what happened to a person like that? Very early on, they got cut off from their feelings. Very early on, they got abused in some way so that they were not allowed to be who they were. If you look at this little chart over here, this is a chart that really depicts a theme that I'm going to be coming back to all through this series. That if you think of this bottom block as you or me at birth, this is what we look like at birth. There's a private self and a public self. That is, there's a part that I experience of me under my skin, then there's a part of me that you experience. Or another way to say this is that this is the conforming self, the public self, and this is the actualizing self. This is the part of me that is individualized, this private self, and this is the part of me that conforms for socialization, if you will, or to survive. Now, by puberty, if you come out of what I'm going to consider normal kind of sex role scripting, see, which is already abusive, if you just come out of normalcy in our culture, although we're making changes and we're trying to become conscious of this, but you see, a little girl is born, here's her private self, suddenly she laughs too loud and somebody says, don't act like that. You stop gurgling when you laugh, that's not ladylike. So this private self goes in, and this public self gets bigger as she pretends not to gurgle when she laughs in order to please mother or please daddy or please whoever. So constantly she's sacrificing her real self to this public self. She has to give up who she is to fit the script that the culture decided on is what makes a real woman. And it may not be like her at all. It may be an act that she has to play in order to adapt to survive. Okay? By puberty, look at how big the public self is as opposed to the private self. And let's say by midlife, that private self is just a tiny little part of you. That most of you or most of us or whoever it is an act, is a performance. Or as somebody said, by this point you've become a human doing and not a human being. That your whole life is a performance and an act. It's an achievement. See, very early on, you go to school and you get grades and you achieve. And they measure you and they judge you. And if you don't meet the measurement or the judgment, that private self, which may be very different, which may be, you may hear a different drummer. There's never been another you. Who are we going to measure you by? See, what I want you to get right now, there's no such thing as normal. Because if somebody's normal, they're the norm. We've got to compare everybody to them. If you step forward and say, I am a normal person, then every one of us have to be compared to you. That you are the measure and the standard by which all of us are measured. What I'd rather say is we missed the mark. The sorrow of not being a saint is that you're not functional. Is that by the time you get here, you're pretending like you're not angry when you're angry because that's dirty or that's not ladylike. Are you pretending not to be sad when you're sad because that's not manly? And so part of you is frozen and split off and gone. Part of you is no longer functional. Your feelings. Or maybe way back here you had such an authoritarian family struggle, you were never allowed to think a thought. If you said something, somebody said, that's stupid. Or that's crazy. Or where'd you get a crazy idea like that? So what you learned to do was to adapt. You pretended like you didn't have any idea, and pretty soon, by the time you got to here, you quit thinking. You see, if you never were allowed to have a will of your own, how could you have any willpower? How could you have any will to decide anything for yourself? And by the end of this program, I'm going to talk to you about the phenomena of Nazi Germany and Hitler and how a Hitler could happen. And I'm going to tell you something that's terrifying. Anybody that begins to understand the structure of families can manipulate any group of people. Because all you got to do is go in there and do them just like they were done in their families. If you come out of autocratic, authoritarian families where you march to obedience, you've never been allowed to have your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own will, you've always had to obey someone outside of yourself, some kind of foreign management, you were never allowed to have inner judgment, inner kind of criticalness that was never allowed you. You weren't allowed to have anger. You weren't allowed to disagree. You weren't allowed to be different. Then, if you don't have somebody telling you what to do, you're going to feel lost. Because your whole life has been geared to living from the outside. And what a compulsivity is a kind of dependency. It's a dependency problem. It doesn't matter whether it's alcohol or pills or marijuana or whatever, or cigarette smoking, it's a dependency. So the loss of this self is the greatest tragedy. This is the sorrow that Leon Bois is talking about, that people get here and they're not who they are in this one and only life. And we did a play, Miller did a play in the United States to dramatize that, a play called The Death of a Salesman, where at Willie Lowman's grave, his son walked away and said he never knew who he was. That's the crisis and the greatest sorrow. It's not a crisis if you don't make a bunch of money or achieve worldly prestige. It's the crisis to have been born and go to your grave and never know who you are. Never know yourself. That deep, spontaneous, integral part of you that there's never been anybody else like. That's the crisis. Now, I want to show you how that gets set up in families. And I want to show you material that Ronald Lang has said, the material I'm getting ready to show you, is to our previous theories of mental health and mental illness what Freud was to theories of demonology, where we had people, somebody was considered to be mad or insane, we locked them up in dungeons, or simply said they were possessed by the devil. That the material I'm going to show you is brand new. It's 38, 40 years old, really. That is, it's really come into psychiatric parlance, is known by the people in the profession very well, but it is not known by the general public very much at all. And I want to make this material available to people in this series, because in my own personal life, nothing has helped me more to understand the dysfunctional family system that I came from, the multi-generational alcoholism. My daddy was an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic. My grandmother was an alcoholic. There's several generations of alcoholics. To really come to understand what the sins of the fathers that are visited on the third and the fourth generation means, and how awesome it is, and that it's a lot more profound and scary than I ever knew, that if you don't understand the context, the family system from which you came, you simply cannot understand how you're carrying that system right now, and how you can be living out somebody else's life rather than your own. And that, to me, is very scary, to have gone, you know, to go to your death and never know what your one and only life was. Now, a very beautiful artist has made us this mobile. And this mobile is a work of art. It is highly balanced. And for this series, I asked her to make something that would represent the systemic balance and unity of a work of art, but I'm using it also to symbolize the systemic notion of the family, that the family is a system. And that's what we've really come to understand, that it's a system, and as a system, it has its own systemic needs. It has its own systemic needs. That the persons in this system, the system is not really the sum total of five individual parts or seven individual parts. The system is the interrelationship of all the parts, such that if I touch that part, every other part in this system is affected by the touching of that one part. So the whole notion of a family as a system is that a family is composed of interdependent parts. That is, every part is affecting every other part. Now, let me say something very quickly. What that means right off the bat is that we've got to move out of an old linear kind of thinking, such as we would blame all the family problems on the fact that daddy was an alcoholic. It becomes a cause-effect blame game. See, my father indeed was an alcoholic, but so was his mother and so was her father. So who are we going to blame it on? And I don't know. I don't know any data three or four generations back. But I got some big hunches that this has been going on for a long time. And that basically, it's not a blame game. It's to begin to understand, first of all, how, let's say if this represented my father, how my father comes out of a system himself in which he was impacted by that system. For example, my father... his mother was alcoholic, and she divorced his father, who abandoned him. And he had two stepfathers, both of whom were alcoholics, one of whom was violent and tried to kill him on several occasions. Happy memoirs back there, okay? So by the time my daddy marries my mother, he's already carrying couple of generations of dysfunctionality. See, again, remember, dysfunctionality means you're missing the mark. Not all the parts are functioning. Why is my daddy an alcoholic? Because, like all compulsive disorders, it's a cover-up for his feelings. A compulsion or an addiction is a pathogenic relationship with a mood-altering event, experience, or thing that has harmful, life-damaging consequences. It's real easy to understand addiction to alcohol or cocaine or sex or Bluebell cookies and cream ice cream, because those things are highly euphoric and mood altering. It's not easy to understand how vacuum cleaning can be an addiction. And you might stay tuned for the weeks to come. I hope I can remember to talk about vacuum cleaning. Or workaholic. How does a workaholic mood alter? He doesn't mood alter in the same way that an alcoholic does. What he does is he distracts himself from his feelings by working all the time. Do you understand how that's mood altering? Okay, so my father is carrying dysfunction. What's the dysfunction? He doesn't have his feelings available to him. The only time my daddy can feel his feelings is when he's drunk. Okay? When he drinks, he can feel his feelings. He becomes spontaneous. He can be sad. He can be angry. He can be vitalized. Because very early on, he, in relationship to the system that he came out of, became dysfunctional. Once that dysfunction takes place in the system, everything in the system is stressed. Just like when I push that, every part of it is moved. Here is my mother, here is my sister, here am I, here's my brother. Every single one of us are affected by that stress. See, because what does stress do? Every organism is geared to handle a little stress. We all have the ability to handle stress so that we can, when the stress comes, you go into a fight-flight response and the heart beats faster and the blood comes out of the lower intestines, goes into the legs, into the brain, so you can fight or run. But what no one was ever intended to do was to live like that chronically, to live like that all the time. So what happens in this system is if this stressor remains, then chronic stress takes over and everybody in that system have to adapt to that stress. Now, do you see immediately how nobody else in that system can have their own reality? No one else in the system can have their own reality because the stress is too great. You're in survival all the time, fighting for your life to survive. This could also be a rageaholic father who screams and is violent, knocks people around, or a rageaholic mother, a mother who's screaming and worrying and emotionally battering people with her constant criticism. This could be a sadaholic mama who's sick all the time. Hypochondriac mama, who's addicted to the feeling of sickness that stresses the system. Then let's say that these two people are not so overtly dysfunctional. They're just covertly dysfunctional. They're both in a sex role. She's one half, he's one half. They make a whole like they're supposed to, although one half times one half equals a fourth. They married and they're playing their roles. It's Saint Mom and Dad. And they're always playing their roles and they never show any anger overtly. It's all passive aggressive. And by the time this kid gets to be 14, he's doing drugs heavily. And so they say, well, we got to do something for this boy. Let's send him to a program. And so this boy goes to the program to get treatment. And the treatment people say, we want to see your mother and daddy too. And the mother and daddy go, well, why? All we want you to do is to fix him. We can't even believe he's doing this. Not our child. We are upper middle class good people. We go to church every Sunday. Okay? What this kid knows is that this is a dysfunctional relationship. That they don't really get along. They pretend all the time. I'm going to give you the vacuuming bit right now. That she vacuums 16 hours a day because she's enraged at this guy. She's furious at him, but has never once said it to him, because if you're in love, you're never supposed to express feelings, and feelings are weak from her system. So the way she avoids dealing with her anger is vacuuming 16 hours a day. So she's addicted to vacuuming in order to distract herself from her rage, which has to do with her husband. So this kid becomes the identified patient. And he goes into treatment. Now, in the old treatment, they would lock him up or put him in a drug ward or spend years trying to invalidate his disorder and never look at this mother and daddy. Or when you get to things like delinquency or you get to things like anorexia, then those are kinds of disorders, systemic disorders, that were just buffaloing people until they really began to get onto family systems. When I do the programs on compulsivity, I'll talk about anorexia, and later on in the series, I'll be talking about ways to intervene in these systems. What I'm trying to tell you tonight is that a whole new notion of mental illness came out of the systemic notion, that you have to look upon If anyone in the system is dysfunctional, you look upon the whole system as dysfunctional. That if this daddy's an alcoholic, we're now talking about a chemically addicted family. Not just daddy, the whole family is chemically addicted. If daddy's a rageaholic, he rages and controls everybody with his rage, then that whole family is sick. It's a whole violent family. And everybody in that family is going to be affected by that in terms of their own reality. In fact, the law is that the more anxiety there is in the system, the less anybody can have this private self over here. Individuation. Another way to think of the private self and the public self is individual togetherness. The conforming self, togetherness self, and the individual self. Now, the higher the anxiety, the less anybody gets to be an individual. The lower the anxiety, see, which would depend on this chief component, mom and dad. If that chief component has low-level anxiety, then the rest of the family gets to individuate. Healthy systems individuate in an orderly fashion. Or somebody said healthy families disintegrate in an orderly fashion. That is, everybody gets to go be an individual. Little Gertrude is going off and she wants to be a writer, a journalist in Europe. And this one wants to make bobsleds in Aspen. And this one wants to be a lawyer or whatever. That may not be anything like what daddy's doing. See, life goes forward, not backwards. But in dysfunctional systems, there's going to be control and rigidity. And every boy in this family's been a lawyer boy. And, we're not asking you to be, but there are very hidden pressures in the system so that you don't have your own reality. You don't have your own reality. See, this system has components, like mother and daddy are the chief component, which is the interrelationship. And it also has rules. For example, no one in this system may be able to express anger but daddy. The rule may be your father can get angry, but no one else can. So that none of these kids grow up functional because they don't have their anger available to them. They either become passive-aggressive rebels. This one acts out by overeating because daddy hates fat. And he controls everybody with his rage and anger. And so this one weighs 400 pounds by the time she's 19. And daddy just doesn't know what to do about it. But boy, is she getting him. You see how her passive-aggressive, instead of saying, I'm sick of you trying to control everybody and make everybody in your image, which is to make everybody number two because you think you're number one. Why would you want us all to be like you if you're number one? That means we're all second best. And what is this making us in your image? I thought we were in God's image. And I thought there was no one else like me. And that life goes forward, not backwards. See, no kid. Didn't y'all do that as a kid? Stand up and do what I just did? So what happened to that feeling if you were being controlled and manipulated and formed in somebody's image and likeness? What happened to it is you just swallowed it. You just swallowed it because there wasn't any workplace to express it. And that is what gets people in trouble, is swallowing it. It isn't the traumatic events of our life that gets us. It's the inability to express it. It's the inability to talk to anybody about it, to share your sadness, or that your mother is battering you emotionally out of her nervousness and anxiety, that she won't ever let you be who you are. Whatever you do, it's never right. No matter what you do, there's something wrong with it. See, and so you just get chipped away, chipped away, chipped away, until there's nothing left of you. Now, if you think that isn't a crisis, I don't know what a crisis is. Is that this one and only life that I have, that's all I have to offer, is this one and only life, and that by the time I'm 15 or 16, I don't have the foggiest notion who I am, what I want. You see, because I'm so dissociated, because I've had to adapt to survive. And you see, children figure out very early on that if they're going to survive around there, they better please those giants. And remember, they are giants. When you're 2 years old, they're five times your size and five times your weight. For me, that'd be somebody 17 foot, 8 inches tall who weighed 800 pounds. Now, that's a pretty scary phenomenon. 800 pounds, 17 foot, 9 inch tall person. And boy, if I don't please them, And I don't have anything. I will die, is what a child believes. So this whole systemic thing then, and then the more dysfunctional this is, then the more people live for the needs of the system. The more functional it is, the more the system lives for the needs of the people. Okay? So let's say daddy's an alcoholic and he leaves. What does the system need? It needs a husband. There's no marriage. So one of these boys is going to be the emotional husband. Will be very severely affected sexually by that. Will not have any of their needs met because they will be meeting their mother's needs. Or let's say daddy comes back and he realizes there is a very special relationship between little Farquhar here and mama. That they are kind of confidants. So he may take little Guinevere to be his princess. And suddenly you've got, and this happens in dysfunctional families, you'll have these inappropriate bondings. Daddy will pick one girl child, mama will pick one boy child, and then you've got all these triangles going. Murray Bowen talks about triangles in these marriages. And it becomes very confusing, confused, because everybody gets fused. Everybody gets fused and everybody gets confused. Now, let's say there's no morality in this family. Daddy's out drinking, he's found with women, messing around. So one kid becomes super moral because the system needs morality. Or let's say there's no religion in it. One of them becomes super religious, joins a Christian cultic group or a Hare Krishna group and comes home chanting beads all day while fighting's going on in the kitchen. The system needs that. Suppose one of these kids wasn't wanted. That child will often become lost, or what's called the lost child. Get lost. We don't need another kid around here. So the best way you can adapt to the system is just get lost. Now this kid will become perfect. This child will become perfect. They will go to their room, not make any noise, won't give anybody any trouble. Mama will say, thank God for her, because she doesn't give us any trouble. You begin to see how the system's needs start getting met. That the system has needs. Let's say daddy's lonely and needs a buddy, so this son decides to be a drunk to hang around with him. My dad and I literally met in a bar after 10 years and had big time together for several months before I sobered up. And I sobered up first and brought him into the program. I was my mother's surrogate husband. I was also my father's father. They used to call him a block off the old chip. So I grew up being my father's parent. Now, that is abusive, folks. Anytime children come out of systems like that, they're getting into abuse. Now, I want you to hear something. I'm not blaming them. And I really want you to hear that. One of the hardest things for all of us to understand is that the material that I'll be presenting you tonight in the next 8-9 weeks is not underscore blaming anybody. What we're trying to do is present data, knowledge that is pretty much known by all the therapists as we deal with diseased people, to try to get people factual data about what happened to them. Because if you don't know the roles you were in, you can't get out of them. You've got to know what roles you're in because they function unconsciously. I'm working with a guy right now. He is the biggest rebel you've ever seen. He has anything he's in, he attacks. And I said, here you are, 65 years old. You have been attacking institutions, presidents, political parties, churches, all your life, and all you're doing is being loyal to the family. Because the family needed a rebel. See, the family had rage and pain. Guess who expressed it for him? This guy. He carried all the rage and the pain in the family. And 50 years later, 60 years later, he is still being loyal to his family. Now, do you understand that if you don't understand what your role was, you can't ever be you? You can't ever stop long enough, get the awareness, embrace the feelings, and be willing to give up that public, rigid role in order to become yourself. And that's the issue here of the lost self, that if we don't understand how we got set up in these family systems, if we don't understand that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and that every one of us, the context of our life is a family,
Now, this is a soft determinism. I'm real clear about that. It means we're not half as free as we think we are. It doesn't mean it can't be remedied. It can be. I'm living proof that it can be remedied. There may be some that will argue with that at times. But I am living proof that it can be remedied. I am living proof that you can change some of these roles. And a lot of people are living proof that you can change these roles and you can embrace your reality and you can become the person you were meant to be. And that's what life's all about, is being the person you were meant to be. Now, not only is this a threat to the individual, if you don't know this, it is a threat to the whole society. Because what I'm going to tell you is that the acting out, I didn't even talk earlier about crime, about rape, about murder, about the, you know, psychotics, about all the kinds of things in our culture, in a society that affect every single one of our lives. Every one of those roles, when they have been studied carefully, tend to show us reenactments of the families that they came out of. They come out of violence. 80% of the women that I've dealt with in drug addiction have had their bodies violated, either physically violated by just out-and-out corporal violence or sexual violence. Something like 80% of the women in prostitution have been violated sexually in their families of origin. That when we study these murders, we'll find that they're acting out exactly what was done to them in childhood. In pedophilia, where there's 4 million child molesters in this country, many of them, 40% of them, are acting out exactly what happened to them in their childhood. So that families encode experiences in childhood, and those childhoods get acted out on society. Now, let me tell you the most scary thing about all this to me. It is a question I've asked myself since the Second World War ended. As a little boy, I used to remember running around singing the songs against Hitler, you know, and when Herr Goering says, "We are the master race, we spit in his face." Remember that? And we had all these little songs we sang, and I remember the Germans were the bad guys, and the Japs were the bad guys, and the Russians were the good guys then, if you remember. And then as I've gone, you know, and then when the war was over, we were glad, and we dropped an atomic bomb, and we wiped them out, and we won, and those dirty, rotten Japs, and those dirty, rotten Germans. And then as I started growing up and thinking about this, and as, you know, I reflect on that question from time to time, somehow I've just always been just absolutely aghast about Auschwitz and Dachau. I've never been able to get it out of my memory. And the question that's all I've asked myself is, how could Hitler have happened? How could Hitler have happened? Because when I studied philosophy, the greatest German philosophers, I did my master's thesis in philosophy on Friedrich Nietzsche, and you had to understand Hegel, and you had to understand the great Kant, Immanuel Kant, who probably was the greatest moment in modern philosophy, and Schopenhauer, and Fichte, and Schelling, then the great German theologians, Graf and Wellhausen, who made the great breakthroughs in biblical study, and Otto, Rudolf Otto, all these people who, these great intellectuals that had advanced culture, and Luther, and the Reformation, and the mandate. This was Germany. And Hitler absolutely took those German intellectuals with him. And if we don't understand how that can happen, then all this rational negotiation about peace, it's just craziness. It's just wishful thinking. If you think that rationality is what this is about, then it has almost nothing to do with rationality. What it has to do with people who are not themselves. That any time you're not your true self, you can be taken by anybody that comes along. I'm going to read you a couple of things. This is Erik Erikson. This is the guy that I used when I did the other series on PBS, The Eight Ages. Erik Erikson wrote a book called The Childhood of Hitler. And he said that for nations as well as individuals are not only defined by their highest point of civilization and civilized achievement, but also by their weakest. And we can only define a nation by both its highest civilized achievement, but also its weakest. They are, in fact, defined by the distance and the quality of the distance between these points. So we don't like to look at My Lai, and we don't like to look at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and we avoid those pretty much, just like all collective families focus on certain things and defocus other things. All groups do that. But those are real things that we have to look at. And I'm not making any moral judgment. I'm just saying they're things we have to look at. When I have read the accounts of what actually happened at Malai, and some of that stuff is just unbelievable, as these soldiers obeying authority lined people up and shot them and killed them. And of course the Germans did that too. They lined massive numbers of Jews up and put them in concentration camps and gas chambers and killed them. You see, one man and several million people caused 50 million deaths in approximately 4.5 or 5 years. Now that's something that we need to take a look at. It is our task to recognize that the black miracle of Nazism was only the German version, superbly planned and superbly bungled, of a universal contemporary potential. The trend persists. Hitler's ghost is counting on it, Erickson says. Now, what is the trend? Alice Miller, in a wonderful book, For Your Own Good, Hidden Roots of Violence, studies also Hitler's childhood. Hitler was beaten every day. Hitler came from the most authoritarian family you can imagine. And as a matter of fact, here's a description of Alice Miller. Hitler's family structure was the exact prototype of a totalitarian regime. Its sole, undisputed, and awful, often brutal ruler was the father. The wife and children are totally subservient to his will, his moods, his whims. Now, when I'm reading this, I want you to think of families that you've come out of. I want you to think of families that you know and see if this is so far-fetched that you have not also come out of families where father had all the power, was in a sense the dictator, could demand his whims, superseded anyone else's. He was the only one in the system who could be angry. Everyone else, daddy could get mad at mama could get mad at the kids could get mad at the younger kids, and the youngest kid could only get mad at gerbils. Whatever. But if you didn't come out of a family with this hierarchy of power and violence, the wife and children are totally subservient to his will, his moods, and his whims. They must accept humiliation and injustice unquestionably and gratefully. Obedience is the primary rule of conduct. Heinrich Hess, when you read those texts of his, Commandant at Auschwitz, they've been read over and over. He was brought up in perfect obedience. You must obey adults no matter what. Now, what Alice Miller says, that a single person can control the masses if he learns to use to his own advantage the systems under which they were raised. Caroline Payne wrote a book called The Neurosis of Nations in 1925. Now, 1925 was before universal suffrage, so almost nobody read this book. It was written by a woman. She argued that the Weimar Republic will never work because of the authoritarian structure of the German family. That it is the German family that will keep any possibility of democracy happening with its rigid totalitarian ruler in the father and his control and the rigid obedience, and that you obey your parents and adults no matter what. You never talk back. You never talk. Children are to be spoken to, but speak when they're spoken to. Children will be seen and not heard. All of that kind of stuff that, oh, we say, but we don't do that anymore. Yes, we do. We still believe we own children. We still believe we possess them. Here's Alice Miller writing about the pedagogy of Hitler's time. Adults are the masters, not the servants of the dependent child. They determine in godlike fashion what is right and wrong. The child is held responsible for their anger. See, you're making me angry. The parents must always be shielded. The child's life-affirming feelings pose a threat to the autocratic parent. If children's jumping around too much or their instinctual needs are there too much, the child's will must be broken as soon as possible. The child's life-affirming feelings pose a threat. All this must happen at a very early age so the child won't notice. And see, the child in you, if you resist, as I go along with these programs, if you find yourself really resisting, I'm going to tell you, there's a child in you that got taught a long time ago about parents. You didn't know what a parent was, and you didn't know what a child was. When I do the programs on emotional abuse and sexual abuse and physical abuse, the terror of that abuse is that always the victim thinks they're wrong. They think it's their fault. I am bad. Daddy has sexually abused me. I am bad. They're slapping me around. I am bad. They're yelling at me. I am bad. Isn't that terrible? And that's because we are educated that way. Now, a feeling of duty produces love. That's the other presupposition. If children have duty, they have love. Hatred can be done away with by forbidding it. Parents deserve respect simply because they are parents. I've heard preachers just recently screaming out, your mother can beat you and be a dope fiend and blah, 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 but you must respect her no matter what. Responding to a child's needs is wrong. Can anybody be happy if their needs aren't met? See, that's how we get dysfunction. A high degree of self-esteem is harmful. Severity and coldness are good preparations for adult life. A pretense of gratitude is better than honest ingratitude. Now think about that. If you weren't raised with some of these presuppositions, the way you behave is more important than the way you really are. Neither parents nor God would survive being offended. The body is something dirty and disgusting. Strong feelings are harmful. Parents are creatures free of drives and guilt. Parents are always right. See, orderliness, obedience, cleanliness, unselfishness, considerateness, but what about vitality, spontaneity, inner freedom, inner critical judgment? How do we keep people from Jonestown, from squirting Kool-Aid down their mouths and the mouths of their children, if we're going to make them automatons and these wonderful, obedient little robots? You see, this is the lost child. This is the terrible thing that's happening. Now, I'm not talking about permissiveness or authoritarianism. I'm talking about getting rid of both of them and being functional people. And if the more functional we are, that's all you have to do is be a functional human being. And you will raise functional children. People who do not love themselves or others cannot possibly teach their children that. So it's a terrible kind of problem. I'm going to sum it up. This is Saint-Exupéry writing. He's on a train, and he looks over in the fourth class section. He sees this beautiful child between two people. He says, a golden fruit had been born of these two people. I bent over the smooth brow, over those mildly pouting lips, and I said to myself, this is a musician's face. This is the child Mozart. This is a life full of beautiful promises. Little princes and legends are not different from this. Protected, sheltered, nurtured, what could this child become? When by mutation a new rose is born in the garden, all the gardeners rejoice. They isolate the rose. They culture it. But there is no gardener for man. Any 16-year-old can be a parent without any training whatsoever. He didn't say that. I said that. You need more training to be an answering service person than you do to be a parent. This little Mozart will live in the common stamping machine. This little Mozart will love shoddy music and the stench of night dives. This little Mozart is condemned. I went back to my sleeping car. What torments me tonight, he said, is the gardener's view. It's not that generations of people haven't lived in filth and been able to make it. It's mankind, it's society that's wounded by this sight. It's society that's wounded by the shame-based people and the lost souls and people who are born to be themselves and can't be themselves. It's the sight, a little bit in every one of us, of Mozart murdered.